Welcome to MedTech Connect, a digital health regulations podcast from Sightline and MedTech Insight. I'm your host, Hannah Daniel, U.S. regulatory reporter. Every month, we interview a digital health regulations expert about the latest and greatest in digital health, from cybersecurity to AI to the fight to protect medical data. New episodes come out monthly, so make sure to follow Pharma Intelligence on your favorite podcasting platform. In this episode, I speak to Michael Freeman, CEO of Ocutrex. His company creates augmented reality products for visually impaired people and healthcare workers like surgeons. I wanted to know more about the development process for an AR tool like his and deep dive into the differences between virtual reality, augmented reality, and extended reality. Michael explained that the largest hurdle for development of this technology in the healthcare space is not really regulatory requirements, but technological advancements and investments, even though surgeons seem really excited about the opportunities that AR technology can bring to the field. Michael, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
And it's my pleasure. Thank you. I'm the CEO of Ocutrex Technologies. We are a mid-stage AR headset company. We have an augmented reality headset called the Oculens for patients. The first application is for patients with macular degeneration. Through pixel manipulation, we're able to let people that have central eye disease in both eyes that can't otherwise see and read again. And then because the headset for surgeons is about 80% the same headset and about 60% the same software, we have the OR lens, which is a headset for surgeons. Importantly, it has the med tiles overlay. So if the surgeon looks straight ahead, he can see the surgery site. If he looks to the left, he can see patient vitals or equipment printouts. If he looks to the right, he can see preoperative information. And with the touch of a finger on nothing except air, he can select a file, open a preoperative imaging file, and then overlay it on the real surgery site if he wants to.
Let's go into the difference between AR and VR, augmented reality and virtual reality, which is a very important distinction. Do you mind kind of talking about those?
Not at all. I love to, because our headset and our whole company is built on AR. Early on, we realized that VR would not be helpful. So let's start with VR. VR is you've got like a mask on that's closed that has two television micro displays inside, and you are totally divorced from your environment. So if you tried to walk or move around, you'd trip over a coffee table, you'd trip over the equipment in the surgery site. And so it has been restricted mainly to just training, where you sit at a desk and you don't move around. You can't be ambulatory. Augmented reality, you can still see the real world, but you add augmented images over that real world. And then mixed reality, the definition of mixed reality is where you can make the augmented images interact with the real world. And then the overarching word is extended reality, which includes augmented reality, where you can see through, virtual reality, where you're totally ensconced, and mixed reality. So extended reality is the larger term, and then those are the subsections within the genre.
So earlier, I got to see what your product looks like. Since this is an audio podcast, do you mind describing what product looks like and kind of how it would work if you put it on your head?
Yeah. So it's got a battery pack in the back. We've got our optical engine in the front. We are not waveguide. I think waveguide has pretty much failed across the board, particularly for medical. So our headset and our optical engine in the Oculens and the OR lens is a catadioptric, a near eye pupil forming catadioptric optical engine. Catadioptric means it's both reflective and refractive. So we have micro displays that are on the outside pointing away from the head so the heat doesn't bother you. And then through a series of lenses and prisms, it presents the augmented reality image overlay over the real world on the lenses in front of your face. So it rests on your head, not on your nose, like some other products. So, and it's equally balanced, and it's about 435 grams. So it's about the weight of your cell phone. And so we've had people, patients, and surgeons wearing the headset for up to 7 hours without any problems or fatigue and that kind of thing.
So I'm super interested to get into kind of like what testing you're doing for this headset, but that really ties into the crux of this podcast, which is how these devices are regulated. It's a complicated area to be in digital health, but also in extended reality. So let's just kind of go over, what are the large differences between regulating an extended reality device versus a traditional device, like a stethoscope?
So if you're talking about the difference between like a class one pair of corrective glasses that you get at your optometrist, it's quite different because we've got all the electronics, we've got the sensors, we've got the optics and all that kind of stuff in the headset. But if you're talking about the difference between a monitor that they would use in an operating room right now, it's very similar. However, I will say maybe the FDA wasn't caught by surprise, but it's been a pretty overwhelming outpouring of new products in this field of extended reality. And so the FDA set up the medical extended reality program where they are trying to analyze things. At this point, I don't think they're trying to regulate any differently, but they are trying to analyze things. For instance, the characterizations of platforms. There are so many different platforms. So you've got AR, you've got VR, you've got some platforms in the surgery field that try to show you where tools are inside a body. You've got some VR that is just for the nurse to maybe count up all the tools at the end of the surgery. And so they want to characterize different platforms. The second thing is they don't really have any good information stacked up yet on all the new sensors. So the IMUs, which would be like the 6 degrees of freedom, which would allow you to pose images in space, be like the SLAM technology, which is the simultaneous localization and mapping, accelerometers, different measurement devices, time of flight cameras, and that kind of thing. So a lot of this is like brand new into the regulatory field. And so they're trying to capture data and data points and that kind of thing. And then the third area that is specifically within the program that the FDA has set up is kind of the cognitive and cybersecurity. So how long can a patient or a surgeon wear this without becoming fatigued or without becoming disoriented, that kind of thing? And what's the cybersecurity effects of it? So there hadn't been any really regulatory increase from that. As you may know, the UL back in the UL Underwriters Labs back in 2019 announced a new 8400 category for certification of AR and VR devices, but it's never been promulgated yet. They're still studying it. They're still getting industry comments and that kind of thing. And probably as you know, this January, for the first time officially, the FDA actually adopted the FDA ISO of 13485 as a actual standard. So, and that's the standard that tells you what you have to do to manufacture to use the FDA's current best manufacturing practices in manufacturing the device. And so that's kind of how I see the regulatory setting right now, is that there's not a whole lot different that we're having to do just for AR, VR, but there is a lot of studies going on, particularly by the FDA, but well, what does all this mean and how do we actually categorize it? I think there's probably over 30 products that have been registered, listed with the FDA that fall under the category of either AR or VR. Most of them, the large majority, are VR and would be like training nurses, giving them a visual on a patient that's having a heart attack or something, showing them where to compress and those kind of things. And so there's very few like AR devices that have been used in surgery yet. We're one of the first. And so it's kind of a new area in that way. But from a regulatory standpoint, since our headset is non-invasive, really, we're under the standard of safety and efficacy. Probably the final thing that I think is different is the human factor and the human engineering factors that go into this. You have to think about a lot of things that haven't been thought about before. I think everybody would agree that if you stare at your TV for 15 hours, you're probably not going to get sick. Your eyes might get a little bit tired, but is that true if you wear a headset for that many hours and that kind of thing? And so those are all the human factor, human assessment. And I think there are some differences, and we're seeing that we have to make sure the headset is comfortable, make sure that the people can do tasks that they would normally do. For instance, a surgeon can get handed a tool during surgery and see the nurse handed him or her the tool and yet still have the visualization of the surgery feed. And so there are some differences in those human factors that haven't arisen with like monitors or, just computers.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't aware of how much testing the FDA is doing. So I guess going off of that, like, how do you feel as a person in the industry about the FDA's regulatory pace? Do you feel like your progress as an innovator is being hindered by the fact that these regulations are catching up to the technological innovations?
So far out of the medical extended reality program, we haven't really seen any definitive additional regulations. Where you see it is when you turn in a 510K paper or something and they want to know more about what does this sensor do, or, you know, what frequency does it operate on? Is it going to interact with any other piece of equipment in the operating room? And that's where you really get down to the questions that they have. I haven't seen any big regulatory moves yet, but I think one of the things that is good is that they've adopted the FDA ISO standard, the 13485, into the actual construction of the devices, because now it gives us a clear path. It had been kind of, if you follow this, you're okay, but it hadn't been really adopted by FDA until this January. And now you know really what the ISO standard is. And so you know what kind of records to keep, you know what kind of engineering records. For instance, every time we do another iteration in changing something, it has to be tested, has to be approved, it has to be documented, that kind of thing. So now that's good that they adopted that, because now we know that is the standard that we have to live by to manufacture these devices. So I don't think it's daunting. I think it's like everybody understands this is a new technology. It's kind of a revolutionary technology. There's nothing like it before. We haven't seen like 3D images, you know, in glasses before. So it is new. But I think the FDA has been very even-handed in looking at case by case. What is the use case? You know, I think everybody's pretty well decided at this point in time that a VR headset is never going to be used in a surgery room. You can imagine the plaintiff's lawyer asking the surgeon, so you're telling me that the only thing you'd see in that whole surgery room is just what was coming through the cameras that was inside the body, you know? But I think AR is accepted for surgery. VR is pretty much accepted for training, maybe for the techs and nurses while they are setting up. I know there's one company that is working on setups and what kind of tools the VR headsets help them understand what tools are going to be needed in the surgery and that kind of thing. So that's very helpful. So it's an ecosystem that is just building. And I was at the VR AR Association, which is the Virtual Reality Augmented Reality Association meeting in Florida recently, where they asked the question of the members, you know, do you think AR and VR is here for healthcare and surgery today, 3 years from now, or 10 years from now? And the general consensus was it's not here today, but it's coming. In the next 2-3 years, it's going to be a really widely accepted technology.
That actually gets into the next question very nicely. Great segue, because if these are coming to healthcare the next 2 to 3 years, what are the barriers to implementation for them? Is it the human factors of it all? Is it the regulations? Is it the speed of development? What do you think?
Yes. So I would say that it is the speed of development and the improvements, or the lack of improvements in this sector. So we saw several companies come out with big, bold statements early on, but they were using waveguides. And like I mentioned a minute ago, waveguides have chromatic aberrations, they have drawbacks. And so they weren't really accepted in the medical field. And so I would say the biggest barrier has been the technology that allows the widest field of view and the highest resolution. So we did not go for waveguide. We went for our own catadioptric optical engine. And so we have the widest field of view, which is 60 degrees horizontally and 40 degrees vertically and 72 degrees diagonally in the whole AR field. And we've also got the highest resolution. Our resolution is 2.5K per eye for a total of 5K resolution to your brain. So I think the biggest barrier is really the technical barrier. The second barrier would be the dollars. People are interested in putting the money in, but they're just, since some of the big guys came out with a big swoop and failed, you know, there's some hesitancy about who is going to be the winner and how is this going to actually turn out. And so I put the regulatory way down the list, because the regulatory, as I mentioned before, as it stands right now, it's pretty much efficacy, safety, and those other three tests that I was talking about, you know, cognitive impact, cybersecurity, how do your sensors work, how do they perform, and then the characterization of the platform. So I think that's a much lesser hurdle to get over. The biggest hurdle is to get a headset that is lightweight, cinematic quality. We work with retinal surgeons, and the retinal surgeons all told us, look, I've got corrected vision 20/20, and I'm not going to look at a headset that's got, you know, less than 2K, you know, resolution, because that's less than what I could see with my bare eyes.
That's an answer I'm not used to hearing. It is usually people are, with especially like newer technologies, are running up against FDA regulations as probably one of their largest inhibitors to getting to market. So that's super interesting to hear about this specific field. Do you know what the attitude towards these devices is within the like healthcare and surgeon community? Have you met with people that are very excited? Are there people that are hesitant?
Yes. So when we go to a medical conference, and if a surgeon stands there waiting for us to put the headset on him, like he's going to be shot in a, you know, execution line, we know he's probably going to want to look at the monitor. We have also a auto stereoscopic monitor that is 3D glasses free. So it's just long, skinny prism lenses. It's in part of the pixels one way, part of the pixels the other way. You look at it, it's 3D. He's probably going to like the 3D. If it's typically a younger surgeon grabs the headset, starts adjusting it and putting it on, you know, he's probably going to like the headset. So we've got about 50 medical advisors internationally on our medical advisory team. Some of them are specifically for retinal and cataract surgery. And then we have a hand surgeon, OBGYN. We have a heart surgeon, neurosurgeon, all these different disciplines that we're expanding out into. And I would say the probably 80% of our investors are surgeons. So I would say the excitement is very high. One of the reasons we just had the American Society of Breast Surgeons want to jump on board with us. The president had to retire early because of the third neck surgery from wearing loops and crouching over into a microscope. We have a thing called DigiLoops, which surgeons have had to use loops in the past, which are just small magnifying glasses on actual standard glasses. But it makes a surgeon have his chin on his chest for days and days and hours. And so we recently brought on Dr. Lionel Hunt, who was formerly the head of spine surgery at Cedars-Sinai. Surgeons like him are having problems with neck and back because of that unergonomic position. And so our headset has the cameras looking down on the DigiLoops rather than the surgeon having to look down. So the surgeon can be looking straight ahead, being in an ergonomic position, moving his head, moving his shoulders, and still see the surgery site because the cameras look down. And the cameras also, typical loops provide about 4 times magnification, and we can provide like 20 times magnification. Plus, we can do all these overlays and the other stuff too. And so it's pretty well known that up to 15% of surgeons have to have 1, 2, or 3 surgeries because of the unergonomic features. So you've got this, the old standard optical microscope, you've got a cramp over it, and it's like binoculars. You know, if you move the binoculars just a little bit, you lose everything. So they got to work these fine motor skills to sit in this one position for 4 hours, you know, so that they don't lose the image. And so the idea that they could stand or sit and be ergonomic, be able to stretch or move, and the image is still going to be right there in their face. They're not going to lose it if they move like a fraction of a millimeter. It's very exciting to them. We had one OBGYN surgeon that had to retire early. He invested and he said, I'm doing this for everybody else that's coming on. I don't want anybody else to have to, you know, retire early because of neck and back surgeries because of the unergonomic tools that we have to work with today.
Yeah, that's another thing I didn't consider, because when I think of AR in an operation room, you know, I'm kind of imagining extra resources, better precision targeting. I'm not actually thinking about the ergonomics of it, but considering that that's a huge draw for surgeons is really interesting. So to kind of finish out this interview, can you talk about where you guys are in the development process?
Yes. Well, we started in 2017 with the patient headset for low vision for macular degeneration. And the whole world shut down with COVID, as you recall. And we had what I call the global chain wreck the supply chain wreck, and we couldn't get parts, we were stuck. And so we pivoted, and that's when we invented the headset for surgeons and started showing prototypes and that kind of thing to surgeons. We've done clinical trials for the Oculens for advanced macular degeneration. We're 510K exempt here in the United States. We do have to go through a regulatory process in Europe and the UK, and the success has been great. If I could show you the videos, tears in the testing room when a mom that's 60 years old realizes she can see her daughter's face, or realizes her son has grown a beard and she didn't know it, and, you know, reading and playing cards and that kind of thing. So very, very, very exciting on that part. On our OR bot, which is the full digital 3D surgery visualization theater, we're just starting. We will this year just be starting the clinical trials, both in the U.S. and in Europe. And of course, since it's in surgery, those will take a 510K pathway. And so we're advancing on all fronts on that. And it's pretty cool technology.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much for speaking to me today. This was a really insightful interview. So thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear more podcasts from MedTech Insight, you can find them under the podcast tab on our website. And if you'd like to hear more from our sister publications, you can follow Pharma Intelligence on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn. Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for more MedTech Connect episodes every month.